Hello, and welcome back to Big Nerdy Questions, BNQ, episode 12. Tonight we're going to get inside the mind of the mega villains that ruin our nerdy franchises. Villains are always scheming to destroy our heroes. Sometimes those schemes are completely implausible and have no chance of succeeding. But other times when you watch these schemes or read about them, you realize they probably should have worked. And for some implausible reason, some deus ex machina, some change at the last minute, some circumstance beyond control, something went wrong. So on this episode of BNQ, we're going to be discussing what megavillain scheme really should have worked. And joining me tonight on the panel, we have Matt. Welcome back, Matt.
Das.
Yes, the two of us will be looking at the villains and what they could have done a little differently. But before we get into the meat of the show, we do have a sponsorship tonight. Matt, who's our sponsor?
Well, Josh, today's episode is brought to you by toilets. Toilets. You don't appreciate them until you can't find one.
You know, that reminds me of villains in some way. You really can't appreciate true villainy until there are no villains in a story. Thank you, Toilets, for your generous sponsorship. We hope we haven't flushed your money down the drain. Ha! Ha!
I see what you did there.
Yes. So we do have a big nerdy recommendation tonight, as usual. And tonight I'm recommending a novel. Specifically, the novel I am recommending is Hyperion, which is a Hugo Award-winning novel written in 1989 by Dan Simmons. First of all, Dan Simmons is one of my favorite authors. He is a genre-jumping author. He has written several books in the science fiction genre, the horror genre, the historical fiction genre, and I find that in all the novels he's written, he always brings me into the plot with his strong characterization and ability to wrench all the possible meanings out of what characters go through in their struggles, if you will. And Hyperion is a perfect example of that kind of story. It's essentially six novellas in one with an overarching plot. Six different major characters who have six different stories who have very different kinds of settings and environments. You have one that's sort of a murder mystery, you have one that's more like a spy novel, one romance, one is a commentary on religion. All the six of these stories come together in a very surprising and interesting climax on the planet where the whole saga is set. Hyperion is the first novel of a series of four. There are three other novels after it, The Rise of Hyperion, Endymion, and The Fall of Endymion. All four, and the four together are actually called the Hyperion Cantos. All four together are an amazing read, but I think Hyperion stands out as the best of the bunch. Although the second one, The Rise of Hyperion, is incredible as well. So I highly encourage you to track down this 1989 gem. It won the Hugo for a reason. So please track that down if you are a fan of good science fiction or good storytelling in general. The Hyperion has a pretty good villain. The Shrike is his name. We won't be talking about his actions in this episode, but it is time to discuss the scum and villainy who might have succeeded. And I'm going to start things off tonight. And I'm going to introduce to this party of villains who are on the cusp of success a Star Trek villain, which is probably no surprise to our regular listeners. Specifically, I'm going to The Next Generation this time, and I'm going to perhaps the best two-part episode of The Next Generation, The Best of Both Worlds. And of course, I'm talking about the Borg. For those of you who are unfamiliar with this episode, and I should state at the outset, because we're discussing plots and their failures, even more than usual, this episode is spoiler-filled. In The Best of Both Worlds, the Borg are trying to assimilate Earth, and assimilation is essentially when the Borg, who are a half cyborg, half organic species, converts anything organic into any organic being into another Borg. It's almost a fate worse than death. And they are going to assimilate Earth, the Sector 001, as it's called in Star Trek, and the entire Federation tries to block them with all of their firepower, and they fail. The Enterprise intercepts the Borg ship. It's a cube, and they fail in the mission, and in so doing, the Borg kidnap Captain Jean-Luc Picard, take him back to their cube and assimilate him. He becomes Locutus of Borg, the ace in the hole, if you will, who, because of his knowledge as Captain Picard, knows exactly how to defeat Earth and humanity. He also becomes the spokesperson for the Borg, which is a hive mind. Remember, there's no Borg queen yet in the First Contact. They make their way all the way to Earth, and it seems like everything is lost. And in the trip, by the way, we have the Battle of Wolf 359, where the entire Federation fleet protecting Earth is destroyed. And this battle actually is where Captain Sisko of DS9 loses his wife. Jennifer Sisko is killed in the events of Wolf 359, an action for which he personally blames Captain Picard. As they're going to Earth, there's really very little hope. The Enterprise crew, under the command of William Riker, who is promoted in the field promotion to Captain Riker, sends a crew and Data and Worf to the Borg cube to recover Captain Picard, or at least Locutus, in a last-ditch effort to rescue him, in direct contradicting the orders of Starfleet. They do recover Captain Picard, but he's knocked out, and of course he's still aboard. And when they bring him back to the ship, the Borg cube is on Earth's doorstep, quite literally, having just passed Saturn. They have no good solution, but Picard wakes up and says, "Sleep." And Geordi and Dr. Crusher think that the sleep is referring to how exhausted Captain Picard is, because they have just made him slightly human again. But Data correctly interprets that sleep is not his emotion, but a course of action, where they can put the Borg cube to sleep, ceasing all major functions, including ship's defense, using Captain Picard as a virus, if you will, to send a message through the collective. It works, of course, and they are able to destroy the ship using Picard's knowledge once the cube goes to sleep. So essentially, the only reason the Borg cube didn't succeed in assimilating Earth was because of a slight flaw in the design of the Borg that was only exploited because the Enterprise, against all odds, was able to kidnap one of their own. Granted, it was one of their own first, but it seems like a Deus Ex Machina type of situation. So I think this is a good case where if the Borg would have done the same thing again to try to invade Earth and just make sure they can't be put to sleep externally, they probably win. What are your thoughts, Matt?
Well, it's you are the Star Trek guy. I'm really not, but it really sounds like a Deus Ex Machina. It's a Deus Ex Machina if I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean it's sleep. It's something so simple, and yes, there's beauty in that answer, and there's beauty in the fact that the Borg lose because of something they did, because they kidnapped Picard in the first place. The irony is, if they don't kidnap Locutus, they probably win with nothing, nothing in their way, because the Enterprise had shown no ability to slow the Borg cube down. So, yes, there is poetic justice in the fact that they're hoisted by their own canard, to use an old phrase, but it's a Deus Ex Machina, and which makes me wonder why in First Contact they didn't just go that route. Why did they have to try to go back to past? It just seems like an odd course of action, especially for a species that does not do diplomacy, does not rethink things, they just adapt. When they're shot with a phaser, the first Borg dies, but then the second Borg adapts a shield so that he cannot be hit by the same amplitude of a phaser wave. This species is relentless. They're the definition of relentless in the Trek universe. It makes no sense that they would stop because of sleep. That's just my two cents on it. Of course, there are other candidates from the Trek universe, but this one is the one that has always stood out to me ever since I've seen The Best of Both Worlds. And to make a stronger statement, I think this one flaw may take away from The Best of Both Worlds status as the best cohesive story in the entire arc of Next Gen, because it's something that's such a simple flaw.
Well, speaking of simple flaws, I think that may be a good segue into our next one. Okay, so you did Star Trek. It's your bread and butter. Now I'm going to have to go to mine, which is Star Wars. A New Hope. The Empire should have won. And they also lost on a Deus Ex Machina. And that was not the presence of the exhaust port, but Luke being able to fire into the exhaust port and actually penetrate to the warp. Actually getting the torpedo into the exhaust port and the depth of penetration required to cripple the Death Star should not have been able to happen. It's the only exhaust port on the Death Star. It's the size of a small moon with a single exhaust port. The sheer pressure being pushed out by that exhaust in and of itself should have been able to stop the proton torpedoes cold and push them right back out. On top of that, proton torpedoes do not normally make 90-degree turns on their own. So I really believe that Luke's ability to displayably use the Force at a level and with such power that he never reproduces at any point so far in any of the other movies is in fact a deus ex machina. And had Luke not pulled that off, or even just decided to use his targeting computer, he would have failed. Yavin 4 would have been destroyed, scattering what was left of the Rebel Alliance.
But yeah, I agree with that choice. As I was explaining the Borg's failure, that came to mind, because it's sort of the same thing where this incredibly powerful villain, and not just one person, but an entire race hugely in power, is defeated because of one simple mistake. And I don't even think it's a mistake in this case. As you said, the exhaust port should have expelled it, torpedoes don't turn mid-flight, and Luke on Dagobah is unable to completely lift the X-Wing out of the swamp without substantial training. So how is he able to manipulate torpedoes that far away, that fast, with no training? And yes, you can argue that Obi-Wan was overseeing him, telling him to use the Force as his wisdom, but it just strains credulity, to use a phrase.
And especially considering that it, in the context of A New Hope, a lot of people will argue that he's not using the Force to make the proton torpedoes turn or to push them through the exhaust port, but he's using it for the sake of the targeting. And in that case, the proton torpedoes would have continued on their flight path and either skimmed the exhaust port, not going in, or they would have caught the edge of it and detonated, because that is how torpedoes work.
Either way, it may cause some damage, but it's not nearly the damage that they need to destroy the Death Star.
Right. I mean, that would be the equivalent of Captain America being able to pick up Mjolnir, but he can only do it once. It doesn't make sense. I still love the movie, though.
Oh, yeah. I still love Best of Both Worlds, but it strains credulity in any event. And I think both of these examples so far are big races hoisted by their own mistake. I'm going to introduce one now where it's one man who could have solved all of his problems with one change. And I'm going to introduce here the cigarette-smoking man, CGB Spender, from The X-Files. First, I should say to our listeners, we haven't discussed The X-Files yet, but it is one of my favorite science fiction shows, TV shows, anything you name, ever. So I'm excited to bring The X-Files into B&Q for the first time, hopefully not the last time. But the cigarette-smoking man is, if you haven't watched The X-Files, imagine a shadowy government figure who works behind the scenes and is the source of every conspiracy theory that you can imagine. That is the cigarette-smoking man. In the show, he started out just as a background character with a few cameos, then he had a few lines, and by the time you get into the second and third seasons, he is the main antagonist, not only of the show, but within the show's universe, he is the antagonist of Earth itself, because he is in collusion with, or working against, or has his own agenda with, aliens. We're never quite sure. He's the head of a shadowy organization called the Syndicate, which is an international organization dedicated to ensuring humanity's survival upon an alien invasion in 2012. But that's been changed several times too, especially in this new season that was just aired earlier this year, where now it seems like the whole time he was heading up scientific experiments to better the Syndicate. Within the context of the X-Files, Cigarette Smoking Man actually did pull off quite a few plots. He killed John F. Kennedy. He killed Martin Luther King Jr. He somehow arranged for the resignation of Mikhail Gorbachev. So he's achieved quite a bit of horrible things. But his major goal in the X-Files is to ensure the Syndicate's success, whatever their plot tends to be. And he is always thwarted by one man, Fox Mulder, one of our two protagonists, along with Dana Scully. Big spoiler here, Fox Mulder turns out to be his biological son. So we don't know that till quite late in the series, but Mulder is the one who is trying to prove that there is a syndicate, trying to prove there is a conspiracy, and trying to prove that alien life exists and has interfered with and visited our planet often. To the extent that the cigarette-smoking man can thwart Mulder, he tries, but he never once does the one thing that you would think a villain of his magnitude would do. And that's kill him. I hate to be cold about it, but if he would have eliminated Fox Mulder from the equation when he could, and there are so many occasions when he could have, there's one episode that comes to mind especially. There's a three-part arc that includes the episode Paperclip, where Mulder has been blown up in the Southwest in Anasazi area, Navajo area. And there's one point where CSM is trying to kill Mulder, or at least he says he is, but he kind of abandons his search. And you almost really think that he's not doing it intentionally. He's kind of holding back. And he says so as much. There's one moment when Mulder tracks down CSM to his apartment through a back channel means. And CSM says, "I can't kill you. I like you." This is before we know he's his son, but it's true. CSM loves having this foil. It's almost like what the Joker says in The Dark Knight. "I can't kill you. You're too much fun." But if the cigarette-smoking man would have actually killed off Fox Mulder and Dana Scully, then he would have had no one standing in his way, because literally everyone else who would have could have been either paid off or bumped off, as is the case. So, in a variety of times in the X-Files, especially in the Paperclip arc, but throughout the whole series, cigarette-smoking man could have succeeded with just that one action that he could not bring himself to do.
One thing that drives me nuts, and cigarette-smoking man is no exception, is villains who have the opportunity to kill the hero and then choose not to. It's to me, it's only slightly better than the ones who are like, "Okay, well, I'm going to explain my giant evil plot and then place you in this easily escapable situation and walk away." Like, really, guys?
As in Goldfinger?
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. He does that all the time. I think villains like to hear themselves talk.
Narcissistic bastards.
I love that band.
That needs to be a band.
It does. Hashtag narcissistic bastards.
Hashtag narcissistic bastards live.
Yes, that's a great hashtag. I'm imagining a band right now composed of the Cigarette Smoking Man, Locutus of Borg, Darth Vader, and whoever else we talk about in this episode, and it's got potential. So fans, loyal listeners, if you want to continue sending us your fan art of all of these villains being in the band, the Narcissistic Bastards, we won't tell you no. No, no. We'll post it somehow. We'll find a way, because that would be genius material.
Well, speaking of potential, I think we should talk about some potential that tends to be underappreciated.
Ooh, do tell.
We all know I'm a Marvel man. I've made this clear time and again. I'm about to talk about DC.
What?
That's right. Bane. I firmly believe Bane to be one of, if not the most intelligent villain in Batman. I can hear the flame war starting. Here's the thing. Nightfall. And they tried to do this with Dark Knight Rises. I did not think they did the comics justice, specifically because I think they heavily downplayed Bane's intellect, which upsets me, because they basically made him out to be just some musclehead, and he's not. He's brilliant. What he actually does in Nightfall, in the original comics, and it starts around, I believe it's somewhere around Batman number 490, somewhere in that area, is Bane figures out Batman's true identity. He figures out that he's Bruce Wayne. And he doesn't just threaten to out him. He actually hides the fact that he knows who it is. And instead, he goes to Arkham, breaks in, and gets everyone out of the maximum security wing. In the maximum security wing, he pulls aside Joker, Scarecrow, Riddler, Poison Ivy, and half a dozen other people who are minor Batman villains who've popped up here and there, like Amygdala. I mean, how often do you hear Amygdala being talked about? He's basically just a not terribly bright guy who's really strong. And he gets all of these people who are mostly lone wolves. Scarecrow, Riddler, Poison Ivy, the Mad Hatter. These are people who, for the most part, work alone. And usually because they have their own individual, wildly disparate goals. And he gets them to work together. Not only that, but he gets them to agree to a schedule. An actual schedule. I mean, I have a hard time getting three people to agree on a schedule to do one thing. I can't imagine imagine getting the majority of Batman's rogues galleries to agree to a schedule for a night. And they followed the schedule. And they intentionally let Batman win every time because they're making him exhausted. And then when they're done, he goes home and Bane is waiting for him in Wayne Manor. Not in the Batcave, in Wayne Manor. Specifically waiting until he is taken off his equipment. He's too weak to fight back, and he breaks Batman's spine over his knee. Then takes him into Gotham Square and throws his broken body off the roof of a building in public. Bane won. This isn't a should have succeeded. He did it. He pulled it off. It took 13 calendar months of issue releases before Bruce Wayne retook the mantle of Batman. I would argue he even managed to not only defeat Batman in a brilliantly effective manner, he also could have, he came close to ruining Batman's reputation because when Bruce Wayne couldn't be Batman, he couldn't let everyone know that, oh, Batman and Bruce Wayne just both happened to have broken spines at the same time. So Jean-Paul Valley had to take over, and Jean-Paul Valley did not quite have the, shall we say, self-control of Bruce Wayne. And he killed innocent bystanders in his pursuit of justice. He actually killed villains. So he actually tarnished the reputation of Batman.
So he became a Marvel hero?
That's harsh.
Sorry about that. But you're right. He completely tarnishes the reputation of the Bat. So Bane won physically, and he won politically.
Right.
So how does Bruce Wayne eventually come back and defeat him? Because I'm assuming it's a lot more difficult than Dark Knight Rises, where it's just like, oh, everyone will do an uprising and save everything. Yay.
Well, Jean-Paul Valley actually begins believing that he was the original Batman, and he actually goes mad. And so there is a fight in the Batcave of Batman versus Batman, and Bruce Wayne barely wins that fight.
But he does.
He does, but he barely wins.
And then he goes after Bane.
No, it just ends there.
Oh, wow.
It literally just ends when he takes back the mantle of Batman.
So Bane did win.
Yeah, he did win. There is an argument to be made that the follow-up is the Prodigal and Troika storylines. And that involves Dick Grayson going back to helping Batman again from being Nightwing. But he never truly defeats Bane. He never actually truly defeats Bane. So you could argue that the only reason Bane didn't succeed is because he, you guessed it, chose not to kill Batman.
Oops.
Because he wanted to leave him battered and he wanted to leave him broken.
Break the bat, not kill the bat.
Yeah.
Which that was a good line from Dark Knight Rises. First I'll break your body, then I'll break your spirit. That's a good representation of Bane. The rest of the movie, not so much.
Yes.
And absolutely. It's not a knock against Tom Hardy because, you know, he did an okay job, but the writers didn't give Bane enough credit.
Yeah.
Especially by, again, spoiler alert, making him an underling of Talia al Ghul. Bane should not have been anybody's underling. That was one of the bigger mistakes of Bane in, I believe, Batman and Robin, where he works for Poison Ivy. Bane
yes.
is his own animal in the comics. He's only slave to one thing, and that's making sure he has access to Venom. Other than that, but he's not a villain to, or a slave to any one villain, as long as he can get the Venom. He is a leader of men, not a follower.
Absolutely. And I think that's the big thing that the movies always get wrong about Bane, is that they always make him somebody's bitch.
Yeah.
And he's
no.
not.
He is not.
I mean, in Nightfall, the Joker worked for Bane for a night. Let that sink in. The Joker listened to someone and did what he was told.
I wouldn't have thought that was possible until
That's
Nightfall.
A scary bastard.
Yeah. Intimidating, for sure. But also brilliant, because the Joker wouldn't respect somebody who's just a meathead.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you say to somebody in a bar that ends a fight before it starts. Oh, you think you're tough? Who do you think you are? I told the Joker to do something, and he did it. Okay, we're done here. I'm going home and never coming back.
Yeah. Okay, bye. Check, please. You're right. So right now we've got Bane in our camp. Bane and Cigarette Smoking Man, who should have just killed their enemies from the get-go. And we've got the Empire and the Borg, who were hoisted by design flaws that were essentially just deus ex machinas because the writers couldn't think of a better solution, the respective writers. So next, I think I will introduce one. I think another one in your vein, Matt, another one in the vein of men who should have killed their enemy if they had the chance, and he did have a chance. I'm going to Doctor Who for this one, and I'm going to talk about the Master, specifically John Sims' Master, in the three-part storyline that ended season 3 of New Who that ends in The Last of the Time Lords. The Master, in this episode, has successfully posed as a British citizen and has successfully run for and won the office of Prime Minister, has had England construct essentially a helicopter or a sort of shield-like helicopter base, if you will, an air base. And from that air base, he enslaves all of humanity and turns the Doctor into a nice version of Gollum, for lack of a better phrase. And the Doctor is just withering in a cage because he's powerless to do anything. But instead of the Master actually killing the Doctor, which he could have easily done, he just, you know, loves his power so much, and he's kind of crazy. So Martha, who is the Doctor's companion at the time, is back down on the surface, and she goes throughout Earth, and she uses the power of belief. Let me explain this for people who are like, what? So she goes around and has people believe that the Doctor can do good. Believe in the power of the Doctor, and he will, and it will happen. It's almost like Field of Dreams met Doctor Who, and this is the product. So thanks a lot, Kevin Costner. So Martha goes around, makes everyone believe in the Doctor, and somehow that belief, when everyone believes at once, the Doctor recovers from his Gollum-like state and saves the day. In so doing, he actually does defeat the Master, or so we think. The Master appears to be dead, making the Doctor the last of the Time Lords. Of course, we find out that's not the case in The End of Time, which is David Tennant's last episode. But in the context of this episode, the Master loses and essentially dies because he didn't finish the job with the Doctor. Instead, just made him his bitch. Yeah, I don't think that was a good idea on the Master's part. I'm glad the Doctor lives. I'm always pro-Doctor. But it seems like he could have had everything he wanted and more just by taking it up a notch. Taking it to 11, as they say. What are your thoughts?
Well, nice take it to 11 pun. Sorry, Matt Smith, you had to wait. And I think you're absolutely right. I really do. And I really think in the case of Last of the Time Lords, the issue is that the Master's ego got in the way. He wanted the Doctor to see him in power.
Yeah.
And that's always the feeling I get. I think that's the reason that no iteration of the Master has ever killed the Doctor, is because the Master wants to have the Doctor see the Master in power.
You're absolutely right.
Or in the case of Missy, the weird kind of bromance, but it's not a bromance anymore because now one of them's a woman. Some kind of one-way sexual tension going on thing.
Yeah, that's just weird. I mean,
yeah.
Do with it as you will. It's a free universe, but still weird vibes.
There are some mixed signals. But in defense of Last of the Time Lords, in defense of the episode, John Barrowman.
Oh, John Barrowman's fantastic, and I say John Sim is fantastic too. He was well cast as a crazed Master. My flaw on this one lay squarely on Russell T. Davies, and I think he was a fantastic showrunner, but in this particular case, I just think it went off the rails. I'm glad to see Martha given the ability to fix the situation, because I think that was a natural story arc for her character to go from where she started the series to taking the lead. It makes sense for that character. But I feel like there could have been another way for her to mobilize people without having it be so hokey. I hate to use that word because Doctor Who sometimes intentionally goes there, loving monsters, anybody. But this just comes off hokey in a bad way. Save hokey for episodes that are supposed to be funny. This is supposed to be a series finale, you know, series meaning season in Britain. It's supposed to be the Master's return, who is the most iconic villain of the classic Who, and it ends because of something so not sci-fi.
Touchy-feely.
So, exactly. Touchy-feely. Exactly. It's, you know, and I'm going to probably get flamed for this, but it's like Luke with the Force, like you just said. I mean, it's a touchy-feely spiritual solution to a problem that really shouldn't have been solved that way. Or to be fair, it's a problem that we had no idea could have been solved that way before. It reminds me of, I'm blanking on the game title, but there's a point-and-click game that was introduced in the 90s, and it's, you know, point-and-click games, you always have to point at something in the scenario in the background, like Monkey Island or Myst, and it helps you solve a puzzle, right? In this particular game, everything is standard point-and-click, and then there's one puzzle with the goat. And I bet if I Google goat puzzle, I will come up with the answer to this game title, because it is notorious. Yes, it is in Broken Sword. It actually has its own Wikipedia article called The Infamous Goat, because the only way to solve this problem was to use time mechanics. You have to distract the goat long enough to go into an open door. Here's the problem. Before that in this game, there was no indication that anything was time sensitive. None. And after this puzzle, it never happens again. It's the same concept here. Never before in Doctor Who has the solution relied on touchy-feely belief. And to my knowledge, recollection, it hasn't since. It's introducing an entirely new mechanic that doesn't work, that just throws everybody off guard. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I would.
So I think we have one more we're going to talk about. Matt, you told me something about that you had a big one to end the show on.
Oh, yes.
What's bigger than the Death Star?
Galactus.
Now I get it.
I'm a Marvel guy. Okay, now, here's the thing. I am not talking about Rise of the Silver Surfer, because Tim's story, you go to hell. You go to hell and you die.
He's with Jar Jar.
Yeah. Yeah, Tim's story, your directing of this film needs to go the way of Jar Jar Binks. Because, first of all, Galactus is not a f***ing cloud. Let's just get it out there. Galactus is not a f***ing cloud. Yes, he's really tall, and he has kind of a funny-looking helmet, but he's not a cloud. Okay, had to get that out.
You feel better now?
A little bit, yeah.
So is Tim Story the villain or Galactus?
Column A, column B? So, the story in Rise of the Silver Surfer is actually based on Fantastic Four numbers 48 through 50, which is referred to in the Marvel community as the Galactus Trilogy. It's the introduction of both Galactus and the Silver Surfer in Marvel canon, and it's contiguous with the current canon, which is generally referred to as Earth 616. That said, Galactus's plot was simple. Send a herald to find planets. Herald tells Galactus about planet. Galactus eats planet. Repeat.
Nom nom.
So, what happened? Well, Norrin Rad became the Silver Surfer, and he became the Silver Surfer to become Galactus's herald. And he did that voluntarily with the agreement that so long as he served as Galactus's herald, then his home planet of Zen-La would not be consumed. But he had to continue ad infinitum finding planets for Galactus to consume. And as long as he could keep doing that, Galactus would agree to never go back to Zen-La. Well, enter Earth. Surfer finds Earth. He identifies it as something for Galactus to eat. And he tells Galactus, because it's his job. But then he decides, no, I need to protect this planet because of all the beauty it's capable of. Insert a little romance-y stuff with a blind woman who does, I think, sculptures or something. He turns good, and he helps fight off Galactus until the Fantastic Four can return with the Ultimate Nullifier. And no, that is not me trying to build up hype for a weapon. That is the literal name of it. It is literally just called the Ultimate Nullifier. And what does it do? I'm so glad you asked, Josh.
What does it
Nobody
do?
Knows. It's the universe's most devastating weapon. And they're pretty sure that the wielder can destroy any target they choose, so long as they focus hard enough.
So what makes it different from the Infinity Gauntlet?
It's a one-trick pony.
Ah.
All it can do is destroy, completely eliminate a target. But if you don't focus hard enough, it'll kill you. So, yeah, basically they used that, wiggled it in Galactus's general direction. He's like, okay, dudes, I'm backing off. Now, arguably, Galactus gets the last laugh on this one. Because, yeah, he just lost to a Deus Ex Machina. But he decided that, oh, okay, you're going to keep me off Earth. Guess what, Surfer? You can't leave. And he put an energy field around the Earth, specifically attuned to the Silver Surfer, to prevent him from leaving the Earth's atmosphere ever.
Ouch.
Now, this is actually later used for something which I think, while it was done to be serious, I personally, to this day, find hilarious, in when Dr. Doom managed to steal the Silver Surfer's powers, and then he decided that he was going to use the powers to fly into space, and he flew literally face first into Galactus' barrier, which caused him to lose his powers, which were then transferred back to the Silver Surfer. Which I think is very possibly the funniest thing to ever happen in Silver Surfer. And at no point during any of this was Galactus a f***ing cloud.
Hitting the barrier does remind me there is one other character we have to discuss, because I talked about this topic with several other people, and one character came to their minds. He is the number one customer of the Acme Corporation, Wile E. Coyote, resident genius. So Wile E. Coyote tries to kill Roadrunner over and over, and as I believe you've told me before, Matt, he does not get enough credit for his ability as a painter of tunnels.
No, he does not. Especially considering they actually work. He just paints it, and they work for everyone but him.
Yes, he has Time Lord technology. He's pretty impressive, but somehow he can't kill a bird. Now, I have an
easy... Hashtag Dr. Coyote.
Exactly. So we have the hashtag Dr. Coyote and, of course, the hashtag Narcissistic Bastards. And in a second, we'll fill out that band. But first, real quickly, with Wile E. Coyote... There's two solutions to this problem. Either A, you know, figure out a way to trap the Roadrunner, or B, here's the better solution, there are other Roadrunners. Find another bird. Find one that isn't protected by a cloaking spell or protection spell or whatever godforsaken way Roadrunner always prevents his own death. Find another source of food. You're the most stubborn coyote that's ever lived. Go find another bird, and you might succeed. I don't think every Roadrunner is that fast. Hell, my Roadrunner service at home certainly isn't that fast. So there's other ways, Wile E. It's so simple. You know what he could done? He could go to the local store. He can go to Whole Foods and get farm-raised quail. It probably tastes better. And with all of his technical skill, he clearly can get the money for it. Saying Wile E. Coyote, so close.
He could have instead become the father of modern art.
I love that idea. Wile E. Coyote.
I call this one Rock Tunnel.
Yes. I call this one Rock Tunnel 2. The road has a broken yellow line instead of a white line. Ooh.
And here we see the installation Exploded Coyote in bronze.
Cap, our band, we have Darth Vader.
Yep.
Locutus of Borg.
Yeah.
The cigarette-smoking man.
Locutus is good. He better be on flute.
He will be. Bane.
I see him as a drums kind of guy.
Wile E. Coyote. Clearly on pyrotechnics.
Oh, yeah.
the Master.
He'd be lead singer. He won't take any other position.
No. And Galactus.
Electric guitar.
The largest electric guitar ever invented.
Yes.
Although with his helmet, he actually fits into Kiss, so, you know, to be fair.
Well, you know, those guys are not getting any younger.
All members of Kiss, they take a licking and keep on ticking, if you know what I mean.
Oh, my.
And on that note, I think the Narcissistic Bastards have to go get ready for their next gig, so we probably should, too. But before we go, we need to pick, out of all of these villains, which one of those members of the band did have the best plan that was foiled the easiest, who could have done something to fix it. So, Matt, who's your pick of the most unlucky of the bunch?
You know, I would absolutely love to say Bane, but I can't. And the reason I can't is because he did in fact succeed.
Absolutely.
So I have to give it, and the reason I have to give it to the Borg, I am giving it to the Borg, and the reason I have to is because the cigarette-smoking man was done in because he chose not to kill the hero.
Yes.
And...
same with the Master.
Yeah. Both of them, they sealed their own fate through their own actions. I have to give it to the Borg because the thing is, they could have actually attempted doing the exact same thing and just prevented the circumstances that allowed one of their units to be captured.
Exactly.
And if they had done that and gone round two, they would win.
Yes.
It goes to the Borg because their plan is still viable for an additional attempt.
I agree. I agree completely. And I was thinking about going with the Borg, but I think I'm going to have to go with what you introduced first, the Empire. So I'll go with Wars, you go with Trek. Because you're right, the factors in play for them to lose are so implausible. You can't tell me that the Force can defy physics that much, to where the exhaust port doesn't repel it, to where it turns 90 degrees, to where it targets the exact right thing, to where it doesn't hit a wall on the way down. No, just no. No, George Lucas. I spit in your general direction.
Well, here's another thought with that exhaust port. Here's another thought with the exhaust port. In order for the proton torpedoes to go through, because they are almost the exact same diameter as the exhaust port, it would mean that the pressure going out would be plugged and then pushed back in by the torpedoes. So you could actually argue that the explosion of the Death Star was caused... oh, God. It's Beverly Hill. They pulled a Beverly Hills Cop. They put a banana in the tailpipe. It's a banana in the tailpipe.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Luke is gonna blow up the Death Star. Oh, yeah. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, that is our answer for this week's B&Q. The Borg and the Empire, the two big bads of our two most beloved franchises, are potentially our winners again. So thank you very much for listening, everybody. And I do want to remind you that you can contact us on email, which is bnqfeedback@gmail.com or bignerdyquestions@gmail.com. You can also send us a tweet. We're on Twitter @bnqpodcast on Twitter. And you'll get helpful hints. We post hints about our next episode coming up each week, so you'll be one of the first to know what's coming up in the next episode. But before we go for good, Matt, we have some business to attend to. We have to kill Jar Jar Binks. How are we going to kill him tonight?
Well, that's right, Josh. Jar Jar Binks does, in fact, have to die. And today, well, he wasn't quite as lucky as Batman, because he got home from a long day of annoying the crap out of the Imperial Senate. Sorry, Republic Senate. And waiting for him in the apartment was Bane, who promptly broke Jar Jar's spine across his knee, took him to the nearest mountain, and threw him off.
Ha ha. I'm getting an irrational sense of glee picturing this scenario. So I think I should go imagine it even more. So we'll leave you with that, loyal fans, for Matt.
And goodbye.
And for me, Josh, this is a good night from B&Q. We will see you next time.